Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we're getting a bit nerdy. We're talking about new chips from Qualcomm. We're talking about new architectures for those chips, for next year's chips from ARM. We're also going to talk about a USB-C revision that may actually have implications for your devices in the future. We're also going to get into Fuchsia and what that means for Google's other operating systems, Android and Chrome. And there's a bunch of new Chromebooks that Ara is going to walk us through. And then we'll talk about why Amazon should have just given away 17 million PlayStation 5s instead of buying MGM. So, kicking us off, Ara Wagner, how are you?
I'm good. I personally believe that Amazon should have given away 60 billion cookies instead.
Oh, but right. Yeah, That's more in line with your...
That's 7 cookies for every man, woman, and child on the face of this planet.
Really, Amazon is known for its generosity.
They should have been forced to build a homeless shelter. Amazon's mm-hmm.
Eight billion homeless shelters, yeah. Indeed. Or at least 80,000. I don't know how many homeless shelters
one
you can build.
One big, huge one with like a pool and stuff.
They should just turn Seattle into a massive homeless shelter.
Or Bezos' yacht.
Right. His yacht's yacht, because he's his yacht has a secondary yacht, apparently. That's Jerry. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right. It's Friday morning. We're recording this on Friday. We did it again, folks.
Sorry.
Rounding out the troop here, Harish, what's going on?
I'm good. I finally got the PlayStation 5, so yeah, looking forward to setting that up.
Okay, so Bezos only needs to send 16,999,999 because you have one now.
I can take an RTX 3080.
Okay, yeah, me too, actually. I tried to buy one yesterday. I got word that Best Buy here in Canada had stock of a 3070. Ah. And I like frantically refreshed and it was gone by the time I got there.
Well, the 3080 Ti is coming next week, so we can look forward to not buying that either.
Right, but at least it might give people who have been waiting for a 3080 reason to, you know, wait for the 3080 Ti, and then people like me who may not need the 3080 Ti can buy the cheaper one.
You're right. I couldn't buy a 2080 and ended up having to buy a 2080 Ti, and now I'm so glad.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. All right. Well, we're gonna go smaller in terms of chips, in terms of power, in terms of and raise the efficiency, and talk a little bit about Qualcomm and ARM. So this week, Qualcomm had a bunch of announcements. One more interesting than the other, I think. Harish, walk us through the Snapdragon 7C Gen 2, because this doesn't really apply to phones, but it might impact some of the Chromebooks that we see on the shelves later this year.
Right. So the 7C is a platform that's designed primarily for notebooks. So it uses the same ARM cores that Qualcomm uses in phones. But the difference is that these have different power restraints. So this can go up. These aren't constrained thermally as you would find on phones. So that technically means you'll get slightly better performance, and they're better at sustained delivering sustained performance. And so what we're getting with the 7C Gen 2 is basically the same chip as the 7C, the platform initially rolled out, I think, back in 2019. They're doing a mid-cycle refresh. The only thing they're changing with the actual hardware itself is that they're increasing the frequency by 2.5 gigahertz, I think. It was up from 2.4 gigahertz, so a marginal increase in frequency. But what they're differentiating it is via the AI stuff. So they're rolling out a lot of AI features in it. They're saying that they're going to use the Hexagon 670 cores on it to enable better audio and video calls, so that if you're using a Chromebook or an entry-level Windows notebook, you'll be able to do better video calls with a machine powered by the 7C Gen 2.
But the actual cores, these are not powerful Cryo cores. I mean, this is basically equivalent to like 2018, 2019 mid-range Android phone power, right?
Correct. I think the actual cores they're using are still the A76. So, you're not going to see a whole lot of performance, particularly from this chipset, because Qualcomm was very clear in mentioning that this was aimed at that $300 to $500 price point. So it's not going after performance. What it was instead targeting was efficiency. So they're touting somewhere around 16 to 20 hour battery life and 4G connectivity, and that to global 4G, so that device makers don't have to bother about adding their own 4G module or something like that. So they're prioritizing efficiency and connectivity instead of performance.
Google and Apple have shown us that if you have a dedicated piece of silicon to handle some of the AI load, it does improve performance overall, because Apple does that with their really powerful series of chips. Google had its neural core, which made a big difference in things like Assistant and the camera. So I think this is going to perform better than we think.
Yeah, I think Qualcomm has shown that, at least until now with the Windows ARM on ARM stuff, that it can scale its designs up, because with the ACX platform, that was actually really great in terms of performance. And even though this is aimed at that budget segment, Qualcomm is still saying that it'll deliver like up to a 60% increase in performance per watt over similarly priced Intel designs. So you will get that better efficiency.
All right, what did we find from the first gen Chromebooks powered by the 7C?
It's still early days, because I think they're still optimizing things a little bit, but there's more hang than I would like to see on the Chromebook Spin 513. I was using it yesterday while I was testing out those docking stations. But I came back to it again. I've been sampling one of the Chromebooks that we're going to talk about a little later. But the 513, it's okay. It's just not great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Chrome leans on AI yet.
Yeah.
As much it as could. Like Android, I mean, or iOS does.
Yeah. And it's one of those things of, I don't see this coming to any Chromebooks this year, because if it was, we would already be seeing like testing rigs with it inside. So maybe we'll get the Gen 2 ones next year, middle of next year. But I don't think we're going to see them this year, because they would already be testing. They would already be getting like, because there's a lot that a processor, there's a lot that Google needs to do whenever there's a Chromebook with a new processor platform inside.
Yeah, so they mentioned that was one of the reasons they didn't overhaul the chipset itself. They mentioned that the first products based on this will launch sometime over the summer. And they clearly indicated that Chromebooks would be a priority this time. With the original 7C, I think their focus was primarily on Windows. But now I think they've pivoted and said that they're giving equal preference to Windows and Chromebook. So Chromebook design. So I think we should see at least some products, because it's chip and pin compatible with the 7C. So there's not a whole lot that device makers need to do to switch it out for the 7C. So I don't think it should take that long.
Alrighty. I mean, if they overhaul the Chromebook 513 in the span of 6 months, I'm going to wonder why they just bothered launching the first one at all after the delays that it had. But I'll be happy to see it. I'll be happy to test them. I'm just not going to get my breath up. I'm not going to get my hopes up and hold my breath, because I know that whenever we get a new chip platform on Chrome OS, we have about a 6 month window where they're still working out all the bugs. So even if we get them later this summer, that means they're not going to be as good as they can be until CES, basically.
But I think the exciting thing here for Chromebooks is now we have a generic off the shelf chip that's designed to split the load and pull some of the machine learning and AI off the main CPU. Now the people who make Chrome and Chromium can work with that and improve Chrome's performance on this chip in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, also, like, if Chrome is ever going to be a platform where Android apps are treated as first class citizens, it needs to have the ability to tap into those neural network and machine learning APIs that are so integral to Android. Right. And Qualcomm has more access to those libraries than an Intel or AMD chip. And I don't know how much difference that's going to make in terms of day-to-day performance, but I'm guessing it, even if it's just a spec on paper, Qualcomm may be able to say, well, look, like if you will, if you run mobile apps on this computer, a Qualcomm-based Chromebook is your best bet for these reasons. And it'll only get better as, you know, adoption increases and developers take it more seriously. So this does seem like even though the performance per watt isn't enormous, it's certainly good enough for most entry-level Chromebooks. Battery life seems really good. And in 2 or 3 years, when all the kinks are worked out and Qualcomm has released like its fifth generation 7C, then we're gonna be happy that it exists because this foundational work has been done. Whether Android apps themselves are still going to be crap on Chromebooks, that's more of a Google thing.
Yeah.
But Qualcomm's doing the work, making it at least a bit more compatible with the machine learning side of things, with the Hexagon DSP.
I'm sure that, you know, Google is just as interested in using, you know, this processor in for Chromebooks as Microsoft was for Windows notebooks. And Microsoft did a bang up job. They did a really good job. I mean, I was surprised, especially with the 8C, which is a little more powerful. But anyway, the ball's in Google's court now. Now they have hardware that they can sort of tailor Chrome to work a lot better with.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on and talk about the other Qualcomm announcement from this past week, which is the Snapdragon 778G. This is a mid-range chip, a follow-up to the 765G, the 775G. I'm confused because there was a 780 released and were announced in March, Harish. So maybe you can debunk some of the, or just explain some of the disparities between the two, because they run, they have the same CPU and GPU combo.
Yeah.
They're both, you know, they're both using similar ISP and DSP backends. So what's really the difference between the seven, I'm going to get this wrong so many times, the 778 and the 780?
There isn't a whole lot of difference. It's basically a slightly underclocked version of the 780G. It's using the same core clusters, but the Adreno 642 is underclocked marginally, just so that Qualcomm can say that, hey, look, we're offering this at a lower price point, and this is what you lose out on. I think that is the only differentiation from a hardware point of view, because otherwise it's using the same Hexagon processor. It's using the same ISP. There's nothing really different with the platform itself. But the main differentiation comes with the fact that it's a 6-nanometer design. So with the 780 being a 5-nanometer design, I think Qualcomm wanted to hedge its bets in terms of manufacturing with the global chip shortage. So it has the 780 on the 5-nanometer that's being built at Samsung. So I think the 6-nanometer, it can, you know, give it out to another fab like TSMC and have like a parallel chipset that's aimed at the same segment.
So it's not necessarily going to cost less, or will it? Is it inherent to a, this is also something that I've wondered, right? If we're at a point where Samsung's 5-nanometer fab is mature, is it always cheaper to manufacture at a bigger manufacturing process like 6 or 8 nanometers? Or is it just that you get more output per wafer because each chip itself is, each core is smaller, or each SoC is smaller?
I think at this point, with where we are at with 5-nanometer, I think it's equivalent, because the amount of yields that you get on a 5-nanometer design should be equivalent to what you would get on a 6-nanometer when you account for the increased die size. So I think that's largely the same, but I think this is more to account for the fact that they want to make sure that they have either this or that available to device makers. And as for, I think it's better that they're going with the 7.8. I mean, I like the fact that the 7.8 exists, and that has been the de facto standard for most mid-range phones. we're going to see a lot of devices with that. I think the only one that I've used so far is the Xiaomi Mi 11 Lite, and it is much better over the 765G because it's using new cores. So in that context, I think the only reason they even bothered to launch this was because they wanted to hedge their bets on the manufacturing side of things.
That makes a ton of sense. And if they can offer it cheaper and consumers don't really care if they're getting a phone with a 778 or a 780, all the better.
Well, it's got the same modem as the 780 too, right?
Yeah, it's got the X53.
I don't think you're going to see any difference if you had a phone with a 780 in one hand and a 778 in the other. I don't think you'd see any difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, this is going to be a strategy that we see from Qualcomm going forward, because looking at the manufacturers that have committed to the 778, these are mostly Chinese brands that sell their phones in Asia. So we have Honor. That should be exciting because we haven't really seen what Honor is going to do after shifting away from Huawei. And we also have IQ. IQ is Vivo's sub-brand. So they're gaining a lot of momentum in India and other parts of Asia. There's Motorola, Oppo, Realme, and Xiaomi. So I think for a more global-focused device, like something that OnePlus would come out with, we'll see the 780G. But for something that will probably be predominantly sold in Asia, we'll see the 778G.
All right, that's Qualcomm. Let's move on and talk about ARM's big announcement this week. We covered it. You two delved into the details. There's a new, three new architectures as part of the ARM V9 family. It's the Cortex X2, which is the follow-up to the big core announced last year, the Cortex X1 that debuted in the Snapdragon 888, and the Exynos, I forget what Samsung's equivalent of that is all the time. There's the Cortex A710, which is the follow-up to the Cortex A78. And then the major design change is in the Cortex A510, which is the little efficiency cores that are in every phone. But this is a completely new design, much more efficient. ARM says that it is equivalent to a Cortex A73 from 2017, but it's 35% more efficient. So you're basically getting the performance core equivalent performance from a few years ago, but in a much more efficient design. So Jerry, Harish, walk us through what this is going to look like for the next couple of years.
I wanted to title this post when I wrote it that ARM builds a new architecture for MediaTek, because that's who's going to benefit here hugely. Qualcomm, Apple, they take ARM designs and just twist them into something completely different. But MediaTek, and you know, I don't even want to mention HiSilicon because I don't think they make any chips anymore. But MediaTek, it builds a basic ARM CPU.
And Samsung. I mean, you can't discount Samsung.
Well, but Samsung's now working with AMD, so they've moved away from that.
But that's just for the Mali stuff. They're still going to use the same ARM cores.
Oh, well, that's good. But it follows the same path forward as we were talking about with, you know, the 7C. They've not only, you know, made the architecture so the cores are more efficient and perform better, but they've also built in, they call it the total compute package. I think that's what they call it. Yeah, total compute solution. And it has, I'm sitting here looking at my notes so I make sure I say the right words. The CoreLink CI700, which is a security solution, and the CoreLink NI700, which is network on chip. And both of those have, the way they work is with separate coprocessors that can handle machine learning boosting and AI performance increases, a better GPU. And that's combined with these stronger and more efficient cores. And I think that's going to be the big difference you would see in performance if you had just a straight CPU made completely to the ARM spec. The X2, the performance boost, there wasn't much on the X2. But still, the one thing they did want to mention about the X2 is that they will continue to work with manufacturers like they did with the X1 from the design phase forward. But now they will tailor even, you know, more tailor the design so that you see the same amount of increase even on a larger nanometer, you know, larger fabrication size. Let's say you can't find the parts to build a 5-nanometer chip, so you have to build a 7-nanometer chip. ARM is saying that you'll still see, you know, 300% faster machine learning, 40%, you know, better performance overall than you would had you used the V8 architecture. So that's a big deal.
What's the TLDR here, Harish? Because we're, you know, it's very difficult for people to abstract a lot of, like, the relationship between ARM and the companies that Jerry mentioned, Qualcomm, Apple, MediaTek, Samsung, HiSilicon. It's difficult to often understand their relationship, right?
Yeah.
And the product that you end up getting in your phone is like layers of abstraction away from an announcement like this, which is very much, it's literally an architecture. It is a framework by which companies can license a design to build their own processors. And depending on the license that they purchase from ARM, they can either take it as is, unchanged, like what MediaTek tends to do, or if you're Qualcomm, you buy a license to be able to modify the ARM V9 architecture in whatever way you want and build versions of it to suit your customers. And in Qualcomm's case, it's the customers are the manufacturers, Samsung, Motorola, you know, et cetera. So how does this work, right? When ARM makes this announcement, let's say, let's just use Samsung as an example, right? Because Samsung is a huge Qualcomm customer. It's probably the biggest in the world at this point. What happens? Like, does Samsung know this months in advance? Are they already building chips based on ARM V9? Qualcomm, not Samsung.
Yeah.
Qualcomm already has this information.
Yes.
Right? Do they have this and are already building chips based on this months ago? Like, what is their relationship to a design, to an announcement like this?
Okay, so Qualcomm would have been an active participant in this. They would have had information months in advance. And with the X2 core in particular, I think ARM has tried to do something different, because for the longest time, Apple has had the single core lead for, I think, nearly a decade. Or whatever ARM has done, it has not been able to meet Apple's any of the A series designs. So what it did last year was talk to manufacturers and get a sense of what they were looking for in terms of single core performance and tailored that X core. So that's the key difference. Well, we're already seeing that with current gen chips, right? With the Snapdragon 888 and the Exynos 2100. So the X1 has already proven to be able to offer that huge performance boost and close the gap to the A14 in terms of single core performance. So with the X2 being the direct successor to the X1, I think what Qualcomm would have done is shared feedback with ARM and even Samsung for that matter, or MediaTek. They would have shared their designs and said, okay, this is what has worked and this is where we need to tweak a few parameters. And ARM would have incorporated that into the design for the X2. And that they're touting a 30% performance increase, but with the way the high-end chipsets are right now, I don't think that will be clearly evident once we get phones based on the X2 core, because I didn't see any difference going from the 865 to the 888 anyway. So it may not be a very tangible difference, but where we're actually going to notice a much better difference is thanks to the A510 core. Whereas the X2 and the A710 are direct successors of something that was already existing, the A510 is designed from the ground up to increase that efficiency. Yes, you're right in saying that it offers the same level of performance as the A73. And that's great, because most of the time your phone relies on these little cores. And that's why you see four cores being the little cores, because for routine day-to-day tasks, like just scrolling through the web or anything like that, it's the little cores that do a bulk of the heavy lifting. So the fact that we're getting much more efficient cores means that it's going to deliver huge dividends in terms of battery life and just energy efficiency.
Well, it can. This now it moves the onus to phone designers to make sure that their product, that those 510 cores can just run and run and run and run and run and not get throttled down.
Yeah.
They're more efficient, but they're going to handle so much more of the load that they're, you know, going to have to make sure that there's a, you know, some way to handle the heat. And phone manufacturers can do it. That Red Magic phone I had the other day, it's just got a Snapdragon 888, same as the Galaxy S5G. And when it comes to benchmarking and playing games, you can actually see the difference. It's better, but it's got a big fan in the back. That's not a great solution. Yeah. But if you can find a way to cool it, this is going to make a big, big difference.
We should also mention that for the X2 and the A710, this is the last of a multi-year generation design. And that next year, ARM is promising a brand new architecture for its higher performance cores that should offer more actual year-over-year performance improvement from a single and multi-core perspective. And a lot of the work done to improve performance this year is around increasing the cache size, increasing efficiency so that you can that they can bump core speeds and not necessarily impact battery life. All these things are the signs of a very mature design. Mm-hmm. And next year, we're going to see that completely new design, that completely new architecture, and hopefully get some, you know, get ARM processors that are, you know, put inside Qualcomm and MediaTek and Samsung devices a little closer to that A series, and close that gap even further. So definitely interesting, but because this is still very theoretical, not a whole lot more we can say about it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And we will come back and talk about something else very nerdy for exactly 5 minutes, because that's how long this deserves. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Codecademy. There's never been a better time to become a programmer. And with Codecademy, you can learn to code on your own terms. Whether you're starting from scratch or learning to advance, Codecademy can help you reach your coding goals. Learning to code might be the easiest way to change your career, especially when you learn with Codecademy. Simply put, Codecademy is the best way to learn to code online. They not only teach you job-ready coding skills, but also help you build unique projects for your portfolio, earn certificates, and even prep for technical interviews. I've been wanting to learn to code for years, and Codecademy makes it super easy to learn skills like Python, HTML or CSS, SQL, JavaScript, and more. And if you're not sure where to begin, Codecademy will point you in the right direction. You can get qualified for in-demand jobs in as little as 2 months, learning at your own pace and your own level. Choose what you learn, from building websites to analyzing data and everything else you could want. No matter what your experience level, you'll be writing real working code in minutes. With instant feedback, your code is tested as soon as you submit it, so you always know if you're on the right track. And Codecademy has interactive platforms to help you learn what you're doing. Build your portfolio and get a certificate of completion to make yourself more marketable to future employees. So join the millions of people learning to code with Codecademy and see where coding can take you. Get 15% off your Codecademy Pro membership when you go to codecademy.com and use promo code Android. That's promo code Android at codecademy.com to get 15% off Codecademy Pro, the best way to learn to code. That's CodeCademy.com, promo code Android. All right, Ara, I want to bring you into this. You wrote a story on Wednesday called USB-C and Power Delivery Revisions Add 240-Watt Extended Power Range Support. What the hell does that mean? And should I buy another fire extinguisher?
First off, I don't think you need the fire extinguisher yet because it's going to take a while for this to actually trickle out into devices that actually can use it. Because this is just the specifications being finalized. Now we need manufacturers to actually build things with these new protocols. So USB-C is great for a lot of things. And like, I have Chromebooks. Chromebooks only pull 45 watts, so I can just plug in a Chromebook with a USB-C adapter and or a USB-C like hub or docking station, and I'll get all the power I need. I can do video output and I can do all my USB-C peripherals. But for like MacBooks and for more powerful like gaming and like seriously powerful laptops, the limit of power delivery right now is 100 watts, and that's not enough for these devices. So the USB Implementers Forum has developed the extended power range so that way it can offer speeds that more powerful devices need. So now instead of your limit being 100 watts, your limit is 240, which is great because for bigger, more beefy PCs like gaming laptops and really powerful like high-end workstations, you were still having to use some kind of proprietary like barrel connector in order to charge your laptop at top speed. So this will mean that that companies like Razer can start using USB-C for power once they finish getting this spec into their chargers and into their laptops. So that's great for them because that means that the highest of the high-end PCs can get in on all the stuff that the lower, less powerful laptops have been getting in on for the last 3 years, which is great. So that was basically the big thing for the revision that we had here. Jerry, I know that you can talk about some of the safety things that they added in for this because this is certainly a power increase. This is certainly a power increase, and it does come with some risks. So they had to strengthen their requirements around connectors and cables, which is great because anything that requires anything for more safety here is appreciated. But I'm also super duper happy about this because that means that we're going to get another just like explosion in the power delivery charger market because it's like, okay, we got 100 watt chargers pretty small. We got 65 watt chargers pretty small. And now we can turn our attention to, okay, so now we have more than double the amount of power that we can put through. So how small and how efficient can we make these chargers now?
I like that they put out a recommended way to build a cable and connector. And of course, it's just a recommendation. These are specifications that any company is free to modify. No company is going to modify them in a way that's going to burn your house down, I hope.
Yeah,
the part that plugs into your wall, that's simple. People that design that have known how to, build a what equates to a little transformer that plugs into your wall and delivers whatever you need. That's 20-year-old technology. The cable is the important part, and the specification. Ara hit it on the head. If you buy like an HP or a Lenovo gaming laptop, you still have to have a very expensive barrel plug and separate transformer that plugs into the wall.
Or you have companies like Dell that would offer like 130 watt USB-C chargers, and we're like, that breaks spec.
Right.
What the hell are you doing?
Right. Now they can just put a USB-C port.
Yes.
Done. That's how you charge it. I don't know that any of that cost savings will get passed on to the customer. It usually doesn't. But this way, it's just easier. It's better and it's easier, And I'm going to be honest, I'm almost through the, what was it, 227 pages when you take both documents they released.
You're a madman.
200, dude. The Type C specifications thing was 400. The power delivery specification was 700.
And it's, I mean, I read it. That's what I used to do for a living, is read that kind of stuff and try to build parts that, you know, adhere to those specifications. But it's all good stuff. It's another case of, this is what we needed, this is what we wanted, this is what we expected, and boom, here it is. It's nothing surprising there, which is always a good thing. You would think, oh, I want to be surprised with some crazy new feature. Not when it comes to sending electricity over a wire. You know what you want, what you need, and that's what you hope to get, and that's what we got.
Fair enough. All right. That's the 5 minutes. I gave you 5 minutes. We did it. Good job. Proud of you. All right, let's move on. Harish, you can drop off if you want. I know it's late for you. Thanks, man.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. All right, let's talk quickly about Fuchsia. Fuchsia is an OS we've been writing about since 2016. It is finally coming to a shipping product on in the Google ecosystem, but not in the way you think. It is being silently updated. It is the first gen Nest Hub is silently being updated to run Fuchsia, but because the user facing interface is built on Flutter, which is a cross platform set of UX design tools, nobody's going to notice. But the underlying OS is now Fuchsia. It's only coming to the first gen Nest Hub. Jerry, you wrote about this today, about how it's a big deal, not necessarily because it's happening to Flutter itself, to the Nest Hub itself, but because this kind of paves the way for Google to be more confident about rolling out Fuchsia to other products. So what's up with that?
Well, this is a way for Google to test something that they know where the test is likely going to be successful, and it will give them information about what they need to improve if they want to put Fuchsia on products that do a little more. I love my first gen Nest Hub. I'm not going to lie. I love the thing, but it's basically just a Chromecast with a screen. It doesn't do much. It just shows you things that other computers are doing, and it has an interface for Google Assistant. It's not a very complicated device. This was the perfect way to test that, I think. The really interesting part is, what are Google's plans to do after they see just how well or how poorly Fuchsia performs? Because Fuchsia is something completely new. It's got a brand new kernel that Google built itself. It's, you know, built from the ground up by the people who, you know, were a big part of making Android, iOS, and WebOS. So these guys know what they're doing. It's not like it's a bunch of people just they pulled off the street and said, hey, let's build an operating system. They're very confident that this is going to be successful. They're very confident in this operating system, and they would like to do more with it. This is a way to start to see what direction to take it for now.
So what does that mean in a year from now or 2 years from now? Will Fuchsia, like, what I'm trying to understand, and I think what a lot of experts are trying to understand, is how does Fuchsia fit into Google's future goals when it comes to balancing its consumer hardware division? What happens when, like, Android is Android? It's never going to disappear, right? Android never. Is also in so many other places. It's in cars, it's in watches, it's in televisions. It's so ubiquitous at this point that dropping Fuchsia in where Android exists feels impossible, even if Fuchsia can run Android apps, which it will be able to with an abstraction layer. I just feel like that's not what Google's ultimate purpose is for this non-Linux based operating system.
It's tough. There are two things that Fuchsia offers that are really, really good for Google, and they're good for the consumer. The biggest is, we all know, if you've got a Galaxy S21 right now, that it's going to be about, you know, 6 months or so before you even think about seeing Android 12. If our phones ran Fuchsia instead of Android the way it is now, Google could send out Android 12 whenever they want. It's the way the interface with the hardware and the kernel works. It's Google has complete control over that side. We always call manufacturers' operating systems a skin on top of Android. It's not. It's really a custom built Android. But if they were using Fuchsia, it literally would be a skin and UI layer on top of the operating system. And Google just has control over it. Google likes control. We benefit if we can get updates instantly for security and for features. And Fuchsia is more secure, not only because Google has more control over it, but because, well, number one, nobody's talking about this. It's new. Nobody knows how to exploit it yet. That makes it super secure. And number two, it's all in-house, all complete control by Google. It is open source, so it's not like, it's Google doing anything secret in the dark. Security researchers can work on it from day one. And the architecture itself is just more secure. Those two things are great. Those two things are really something that would need to come to Android, and they can't. Google wants to replace everything with Fuchsia. I can guarantee you that there are people in the company that want to say, that are saying, how can we do that? How can we make, send Fuchsia to phones in maybe 5-6 years, whenever, without disrupting the, multi-billion dollar industry we've already built around Android? And that's the big question. Android and Chrome can't go away. You can change them over time so they can work, with Fuchsia as the operating system, but they still look and feel the same and do the same things. But you can't just abandon them.
What we don't know is, how do you build an app for Fuchsia? It's based in C, as far as I understand, right? You can build in C, which Android supports with its NDK, I believe.
I'm pretty sure that you can build once and deploy across Chrome OS, Android, and Fuchsia just using Flutter, the Flutter toolkit. Yes.
So essentially, the fact is that Kotlin is becoming, so Google's trying to replace Java with Kotlin. A lot of developers have picked it up and are now building Android apps based in Kotlin. We have Flutter, which, as you mentioned, is this build one, deploy everywhere style, tool. It just feels like we're still not quite there understanding why Google is building Fuchsia in general. It really does not compute, because there just doesn't seem to be a business reason for it to pursue this avenue, unless there's a third consumer-focused strategy here, potentially around it's smart home hardware.
Yes.
Right? And Nest, where Fuchsia may make a difference.
I can see by 2022, every Nest product is going to run Fuchsia. Fuchsia, on paper, we haven't tried it yet. On paper, Fuchsia is perfect for smart speakers, your thermostat, your products like your Google Home Hub or Nest Home Hub, your Nest Mini. They do a little bit of work to make Soli work in, with Fuchsia. The new generation Nest Hub could run Fuchsia. It's on paper, it's ready to go. It's ready to push out there, do it, because those devices they're not a smartphone. A smartphone is the most complicated computer you own. You can have a big, huge gaming rig that runs Windows 10 and, whatever.
Windows NT.
Yeah.
Windows Millennium Edition.
If you're smart, it still runs Windows 7. But, your smartphone is the most complicated computer you have, because it does all those tasks and it's so small, it's miniaturized, and it's power constrained. If you're asking for my opinion, yes, Google wants to get Fuchsia onto your phone and onto your Chromebook as soon as it can. How soon that is, I would say 10 years, Fuchsia will be completely mainstream across smartphones and laptops from Google. I don't know what the path from here to there looks like. I don't know the timeline. I don't know any of that. I don't think anybody really knows. I don't think Google even knows yet. But you have to start somewhere. I wrote in my post that we have to remember that Android was designed to run on cameras. It was not designed for smartphones or laptops or, you know, TV boxes or watches. It was designed to power cameras, and it was simple. And, you know, companies before Google bought it, you know, worked on it to make it a little better. Then Google invested in it, and 3 years after they bought it, it comes out on a phone. And, you know, you don't want to compare it to what we have today because it would look horrible. But back then, it was huge. It was like, wow. So that's the timeline they have to follow. They have to go slow, make sure things work along all the paths. And then when they're confident, it can handle the rigors and load that you have running a smartphone. That's when they have to start, you know, looking into that. How are we going to do this? I don't think we're ever going to see a third, you know, oh, this is all new Google, you know, Fuchsia, and we're going to stop working on Android. That can't happen. There's too much money invested, and Google just won't do that. They won't drop it. But they'll find a way to merge the two, so to the user, there's no real difference. You know, and all the differences that there will be are better. And, I you know, they have to shoehorn it in there. That's why they make the big money. That's something they have to figure out. And hopefully they don't do it all quietly. They tell us along the way. You know, that would be really cool. So Google, that's what you need to do, is let us know and let us try stuff. You've been great with Fuchsia since the beginning, putting out betas, you know, running it in emulators or on Chromebooks. That was really cool. You know, how about now giving us an emulator we can try on our phones? Because we know that has to be your end goal.
One thing we're not talking about, and we're not going to get to it this week, but one thing we're not talking about is Google's relationship with the manufacturers and their relationship with the carriers, and how Android updates and security is so, I hesitate to use the word fragmented because it's so much better than it used to be, but Google's done a lot to disambiguate the update process within like Android's core from relying on carriers and manufacturers, but it still does.
They've about hit a wall there. There's not much more they can do.
Exactly. And until the carriers and manufacturers relent control back to Google, if they ever decide to do that, which they won't voluntarily, then Google's still going to have that same problem where...
See, Fuchsia solves that. Manufacturers and carriers can do whatever they want, and the underlying operating system is still Google's. They can send out an update today. This is perfect for all parties.
Oh, we'll see. I'm sure Verizon will screw it up.
Yeah, probably. Somehow.
All right, I want to move on because we only have a few minutes, and I want to get Ara to talk about these new Chromebooks. So there are four
Chromebooks
specifically from Acer. So give us the lowdown.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get the ones that don't really matter out of the way. There's the new Chromebook 314, which is just a slight spec bump for the previous 314. We have the Chromebook 317, which is their first 17-inch Chromebook, but it's also only powered by Pentium and Celeron chips, and it's a 17-inch screen that's only 1080p, so it doesn't look great. And then we have our first two Thunderbolt Chromebooks from Acer, which is the Acer Chromebook 514, which I have in the next room and need to keep using. And we have the new Acer Chromebook Spin 713. It's a little impressive that that's getting an update only after 1 year, because the 2W came out last summer, and I loved it, and I'm very much looking forward to trying the new 713. The design is totally the same. The only thing they've changed is they've added two Thunderbolt 4 ports. Excuse me one second. Sorry. They've added two Thunderbolt ports, and they upgraded to 11th gen Intel Core processors. So this is the first Evo platforms verified Chromebook. I don't really think that's going to mean much to users, but we still have that sweet 2K touchscreen. We still have all the ports that you want. Thunderbolt 4 is going to be great for some people because it also means that the two USB-C ports are on the same side. So I think that you can use the same docking station that you would with a Mac. I'm not terribly thrilled about the ports being on the same side and in the Apple configuration, but makes things easier for accessory makers, I believe. So that'll be interesting there. And it's still like the listing that's on Best Buy right now, which was supposed to go on sale yesterday, but it's still listed as coming soon, is $700 for an 11th gen i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 256 gigabyte SSD, and that 2K touchscreen. And that's just phenomenal value for what you get there.
Yeah, buy that. If you're looking for something high-end in running Chrome, buy that. I agree.
I mean, I also just love that since this is, the new one is going on sale so quickly, the old ones are getting discounted. Yesterday, last year's i3 model was down to $330, which a 10th gen i3 and a 2K touchscreen for $330 just blows anything and everything else out of the water. That deal is gone, by the way. Sorry, it's it's dead. But I'm very much looking forward to the new 713, the new 514 that I have. I have the non-touch model, which I'm not very keen on, but also, my model is pre-production because the new 514 doesn't go on sale until August or October, depending on your market. So we have a couple of months before that one will be available. And hopefully whatever driver wonk I am seeing with Thunderbolt 4 will be fixed by then.
I'm disappointed to see Thunderbolt 4 in a Chromebook. You don't need to do that. USB-C, what 3.2 revision 2 is out now. Version 4 is out there. It does everything you need to do. Let, you know, Apple deal with the Thunderbolt issues because they're good at it. They know how to do it. That's just going to be problems for a year.
Yeah, I can't say I disagree with you, Jerry, because whenever I plugged the 514 into my docking stations, instead of it pulling power from the docking station, it tried to power the docking station and instead started draining the battery. And I'm like, what the? You're supposed to be charging your 5%, no. And then I had to go grab a cable and plug in to the second USB-C port in order to power the Chromebook. So,
hey, don't get me wrong. Thunderbolt has its advantages, and that's why, you know, it was developed, and that's why companies use it. But a Chromebook was always, from the, you know, day one, supposed to be a little more simple, and that takes a little bit of the simplicity away.
I mean, it's also one of those things of Thunderbolt 4 is more for, like, if you're powering like four or five different screens and if you're having to push like gigabits and gigabits of data a second, most, like the vast majority of Chromebook users, even like I work full time on a Chromebook and I don't need that. The vast majority of people who do work full time on a Chromebook do not need that.
Yep.
But it's good for, I guess, code develop. I don't even know if it's good for code developers,
I guess it's good for
whoever, I don't know, dual boots Linux and uses it for video editing or CAD or something. I don't know.
What do you think about the low end? Because that, be realistic, that's the important one. That's the one the schools are going to buy.
I don't think it's the one the schools are going to buy. Acer came out with a whole slew of education PCs back at BET in January. I still can't find any of them for sale. Like all of the education Chromebooks that were announced in January, the only one I've seen is one from HP, and it was the lower end of the four or five that they announced. And the rest of them, I'm just like, where is everybody? It's May. Like, these should be out and available for consumers. So that way, we actually see retailer availability that's, you know, respectable by the time back to school rolls around. So where are they?
To me, that's where Chrome's problem is right now, is the, you know, schools have to buy the cheapest product. They just can't afford to do. And that's just what they have to do. And the really cheap Chromebooks just don't cut it anymore.
Well, so, they cut it for everything except video conferencing, which is why a lot of them got their ass kicked this year.
Yeah.
Because 4 gigabytes of RAM is fine for just about everything that isn't CAD programming or audio video editing. But Google Meet will eat your RAM alive if you're not careful. And if you're in a classroom and you're trying to see all of your classmates on a Google Meet call while still keeping your notes open in another tab, 4 gigabytes ain't enough, man. Like, even I have to try and limit the number of tabs I have open during a Google Meet call. And that's on Chromebooks with, like, an i3 or an i5.
Hmm.
But granted, I mean, One of the things that made me happy was when they announced during one of the web sessions was that they had they'd had some kind of processor or AI update, and it made Google Meet like 200% more efficient. But that might have just been that they made blurring the background 200% more efficient. But yeah. literally anything that makes Meet more optimized and easier on your RAM is a good thing.
And presumably we think that's going to make, you know, things like Zoom run better too. So
ideally,
nobody needs Zoom to run better. Not at the moment anyway.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they do, obviously, but nobody wants to spend more time in it.
All right, other podcast.
Let's move on. So I wanted to mention quickly that Amazon spent $8.5 billion buying MGM, which owns a number of well-known franchises, including the Bond franchise, although sort of, because Bond is still creatively controlled by the Broccoli family. But if you actually want to listen to it, go listen to Recode Media. There's a whole podcast dedicated to this exact acquisition. Really interesting. Goes into the details of MGM's dysfunctional relationship with the Broccoli family. They also own a number of other franchises. Presumably, many of them will be integrated into Prime Video. One thing that they did talk about in that podcast, which again, I recommend you listen to, is that Amazon is also really putting a lot of effort into building its IMDb, its free IMDb channel, which is ad supported. And the more crappy back catalog content that Amazon can throw at it, the more likely people are to stick around and watch all day, every day, just like a terrestrial cable channel. So hence the acquisition. Ara put together a really funny list of all the things that Amazon could have bought instead of spending $8.5 billion on MGM, hence the 17 million PS5s and 60 billion cookies. Read that. It's really funny. We're going to take another quick break, and we're going to come back and do our What's Making Us Happy. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by NordVPN. You have heard tons of people tell you why it's important to use a VPN, both on your phone and your laptop. The TLDR is that it encrypts your data between your device, the phone or laptop, and the eventual destination where your data is going. So if that app or service is using weak or no encryption, there's a potential for it to be intercepted or used by malicious actors. VPNs stand in the middle of that and ensure that traffic is routed securely and using extremely high encryption so that nobody is going to be able to use your data in ways that you don't want. NordVPN is one of the fastest and easiest to use VPN services out there. It's available on mobile, on desktop, and everywhere else in between, and it is one that we here at Android Central actually recommend. If you go to our best VPN roundup, we've used it and we really like it. So yes, they are sponsoring the show, but we actually use it a lot. And it's one that I've personally used for a long time. So what I would like you to do is if you are interested, you can go to nordvpn.com/ACP for 66% off a 2-year plan plus a free month. So that is 25 months and you get 66% off the total amount. That equates to $3.96 per month for NordVPN in the US, 66% off globally, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee if you're not happy. That is really cheap and you have no commitments because you'll get your money back. So again, go to NordVPN, that's NordVPN.com/ACP. Use our code, get 66% off the 2-year plan, and you get a free month included in that as well. Try it, see how you like it, let us know. Okay, Jerry, I'm ending this quickly today because we all have to go and do work and be productive members of society. So what is making you happy in 30 seconds or less?
It's summertime. I can go fishing. I literally have a little path built. I can wheel my wheelchair down to a stream that's filled with smallmouth bass and trout. And that means at the end of the day, I can just go relax with a fishing pole and not have to worry about it being cold or nasty. And I love it. I was built for summer. I love this.
Amen. I love that. You're still going to have to take me fishing one day.
Hey, you come on down. We'll catch some fish.
All right. What's making you happy?
Critical Role had its last episode of Campaign Soon yesterday. I stayed up to the end of the fight and then immediately turned it off because it was 1:30 at that point. But it was a really good fight. I'm looking forward to watching the last half of the last episode this afternoon because I know I'm going to cry, so I can't watch it during or at any point in the day where I have to be productive.
Fair enough. Yes, please, please don't stay up until 1 in the morning every day to watch
I got 7 hours. I slept from 1:30 to 8:30.
God. People without children make me crazy. All right. Well, I will be very quick. What's making me happy is playoff basketball. It's back. It's happening. It is going to be a LA-Brooklyn final, in my opinion. It's going to be a fantastic playoffs. I'm very excited because even though my Raptors did not make it back this year, it just is great to have sports again on my television. I'm very excited. So that's it. I don't think I have anything else to say. Who's your favorite basketball team? Let us know. Podcast at Android Central. Thank you so much for all the emails last week. I got a bunch of them. Really appreciated every one of them. So many nice words. A few not so nice words, but that's okay. Keep those coming too. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find Ara at Ara Wagco. You can find Jerry at GB Hill. You can find all of us at Android Central. We'll be back next week with a super fun episode, hopefully recorded earlier in the week. Again, we're doing our best, folks. It's busy up in here. Until then, have a great week. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Bye.